Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Currency Exchange, a NatWest Markets podcast all about foreign exchange markets. And today, I'm happy to be joined by Galvin Chia, who is one of our EM Asia strategists, joining us from Singapore. And today, we're going to talk about Asia FX markets. And specifically, I want to start with China. Galvin, since the last time we spoke, you know, over the summer, it's been a pretty challenging period for China from a growth perspective. But recently, as you've been noting, some of the data in China have come in a little bit better than expected. How are you seeing the overall outlook for China as we head into the fourth quarter?
Yeah, I mean, thanks, Brian. It's good to be back and it's good to sort of talk about some of these topics again. I think for China, we're definitely getting to a phase where you could talk about, well, it's the beginning of the end of the bad data period, right? So things aren't really sort of deteriorating anymore, and I think you're emerging. You're getting to this part where you're starting to talk about green shoots, or you start to talk about this sort of turnaround, right? So for example, to talk about what's been surprising. So over the last 2 months, let's say the last 2 months worth of data, you've had GDP data come out a little bit better. You've had sort of things like industrial production, retail sales, all of that has been surprising to the upside. And alongside with that, what we've also been seeing is that economists have actually been revising upwards some of their China GDP forecasts for 2023, right? So previously, where let's say in around September, in around September, people were worried that China really wasn't on track to meet its 5% GDP target, right? And sort of some of those GDP forecasts were just a touch below 5%. But with yesterday's sort of new round of data, or rather Wednesday's new round of data, some of those forecasts were sort of revised back up to be sort of in line with 5%. So what you can start to see in the market and among some of those expectations is that it was sort of like heading past the trough, past that bottom point. And sort of things are marginally, I think incrementally, starting to sort of look a little bit brighter for Chinese economic data, I think, in the aggregate. Right? Yeah.
So you alluded to this, Galvin, but it seems like there's a bit of a difference here between the immediate term and sort of the more medium term, because a lot of the data, like you said, have certainly shown signs of stabilization and maybe troughing in the near term. But as we know, there's still significant questions about China's real estate market and property sector. What's the general story there? I mean, how has fiscal stimulus, monetary stimulus? I think that's certainly helped in terms of sort of helping the near term picture. But how are you seeing these challenges, these sort of medium term challenges, and how does that contrast with some of the more positive mood music we've had in China from the data very recently?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, right? Because, Brian, I think so far for much of this year, China's kept being tied up this dichotomy, whereas a lot of, equity markets or interest rate markets or even FX markets tend to be quite short term and try to price in the possible outcomes from now into some period in the future, right? So encompassing both the short and long term. So much of this discussion around China has really revolved around China's medium to longer term issues, right? And I think emblematic of that has been the property sector. The property sector has been undergoing this sort of very long and drawn out sort of period of restructuring of sort of corrections, right? So just to give you a couple of this idea, right? So even some of this data has started to turn. So some of the data from the property sector hasn't been as bad as it was, let's say, 3 to 6 months ago. But what you're seeing, for example, is that a property, new property starts and sales by floor area in year-on-year terms, those are still in contraction in the double digits, right? But negative 15-20%. Again, 3 to 6 months ago, you were looking at -30 to -40%. So kind of, over that period of time, it's definitely gotten better, but it's still pretty tough. Residential sales, the most recent number, that's -20% year-on-year. In terms of home sales, that's been contractionary for about 27 months now, right? So I think, on the long term, it's undeniable that I think the Chinese real estate market, which comprises such a large part of GDP, as we all know, and sort of construction activity, commodity demand, that's suffered by that suffered from things like oversupply, chronic oversupply. Prices were in a bubble. Real estate developers had sort of these mismatched incentives because they would be incentivized to take people's monies and deposits for apartments, but before that, buildings were actually finished, which results in a bit of sort of misalignment in incentives on delivering on some of these, right? And over leverage. These themes are very, very common, and so I think, on the one hand, the economic trajectory is starting to show, these early signs of bottoming out. Property supply is definitely falling. Property demand is also falling, which I think is helping correct some of those imbalances in the oversupply. And at the same time, some of the stimulus that's been put in place to try to, I think, put a floor on some of these trends, particularly I think on the demand side, they've been lowering minimum deposits, they've been lowering mortgage rates to try to stimulate some of that real estate market, right? So I think overall, and stimulate in a sense, in a way that cushions, I think, the broader financial sector, bank assets, our sort of balance sheets, household wealth, making sure that these key areas of the economy don't collapse. So it's a huge piece of, it's a huge clockwork. It's a very big balancing act. And I think in the short term, or rather in the medium term, some of these stimulus effects, they do seem like they're starting to play out. By putting a floor under some of these some of these data.
So you mentioned the fiscal stimulus, which I think is, like you said, super important in terms of pointing towards stabilization. And one of the themes that we've talked about for China, not just in its recent sort of data slump and more, I mean, more recent recovery, right, off of the lows, but more broadly, there's been this question of what's the role of fiscal policy in China as a stabilizer or force of recovery for China demand, right? I think we're all used to in previous cycles that China's use of fiscal stimulus as a support for growth has been very, very broad-based. This time it seems very targeted, as you mentioned. I know that's been your view, that targeted fiscal stimulus more likely. Is that still your view? And how does that play into your thought on China's role in the broader recovery, and the broader
Yeah, I
economy?
think, definitely. I think that's a really important question because, previously in sort of prior periods of Chinese economic weakness, right, the government would come in very strongly with this fiscal component, which was basically, really sort of either infrastructure invest, it's sort of very Keynesian type of setup, right, where the government would pump money into things like public infrastructure, these bridges, these highways, rail systems, but they would also sort of very strongly direct credit to certain parts of the economy, right? And so that I think led during these periods to this characterization of flood style stimulus, right? And so I think in this period of sort of Chinese economic weakness, you've had a lot of different types of stimulus, and you've had fiscal stimulus in the sense I think more in that credit channel, right, where the government has been encouraging banks to step up lending. We've definitely seen sort of ups and downs in some of these in the credit in sort of Chinese credit supply, and that's on the that's also sort of it's a bit complicated because that's also constrained by how much individuals and entities are willing to take up that credit. So credit demand is definitely an issue there, but credit supply is pretty flush, right? And I think how that's trying to sort of engineer this cushioning is that it's trying to, you're definitely getting the sense that it's trying to get people to spend a little bit more. It's trying to get people to, well, to have a little bit more confidence in the housing markets, right? It's trying to get companies to take on loans to make sure that, they're not cash strapped. But I think on the other hand, there is this very sort of overarching, this very powerful overarching policy constraint, right? These hard lessons that they've learned from the financial crisis in 08, right, from the 14 and 15 sort of downturn in the economy, that they can't overstimulate the economy anymore because they are worried about these really high and still rising levels of debt in the economy, right? So just to give you an example, when you talk about fiscal stimulus, one level of fiscal stimulus that's really come under a lot of scrutiny is local government indebtedness, right? And there's been sort of anecdotal stories, but some very interesting research that's been done, by people, smarter than us, I think. But looking at how certain cities in China are just so indebted, right? And sort of with crushing interest payments, that public services, things like, buses or like police and, that sort of thing, that's being impacted because so much of the local government finances are diverted towards interest payments, right? So whilst on the one hand there is, this massive economy which is slowing, And sort of it, you know, I think it does need support, right? In certain respects, it does need support. But on the other hand, there are, you know, constraints, you know, political constraints, economic constraints, and debt constraints now, which mean that, you know, this prospect of letting loose, you know, the floods of stimulus is just simply not feasible anymore. And what that means, I think, is that, you know, this idea that China, as the backstop of global growth, China as, you know, the world's largest consumer of commodities, some of those notions I think will have to change, right? I mean, to think about the rest of the region, you know, if you think about the numeric, you know, year-on-year growth number, India's growth numbers are looking far, sort of, they're looking like what China was in 2018 and 2019, you know, 6% growth. In Indonesia, high 5% growth, right? China, you know, 5% or lower. So I think, you know, those dynamics about these high growth regimes, right, are sort of the up and coming stars of the emerging markets or the emerging Asia. You know, they're starting to turn, they're starting to change. China is graduating.
So I think it's super interesting that you point out the difference between state and local governments versus the sort of the federal level, because there were some reports a few weeks ago talking about how China might consider increasing fiscal deficits from the highest level in order to provide stimulus. But that's the kind of thing that, you know, if the stimulus really is coming from the state, and if the issues are coming more from the state and local level, there might be a little bit more hesitancy or inability to sort of deliver that stimulus. The transmission from stimulus from sort of the top line federal government into the real economy, you know, that's going to be an important theme going forward. I do want to talk about foreign exchange markets now, because the dollar has been extremely strong pretty much against everything since the start of August. You know, really since the middle of the summer, the dollar has been on a rising trend, and you know, those themes are as much about the dollar as they are about any other currency. Relative growth extremely strong, very resilient U.S. economic growth that continued this past week. We had retail sales this week that came in much stronger than expected. The employment market continues to perform extremely well, and with it, that's fueling market expectations for higher for longer policy to be entrenched in U.S. rates. And so relative rates and relative growth have continued to push in favor of the dollar. But if you look at the broad dollar, something like the DXY, and compare that to dollar CNH or dollar CNY, you do see the dollar CNH has been very stable for a lot of this period at around 7:30. So that seems to me like official intervention may be part of the reason why the Chinese currency has held up, even as the dollar has strengthened broadly against a lot of other currencies. Is that what you're seeing? And how are you thinking about the Chinese currency with all of these interplays between China's growth and this seeming unstoppable U.S. economy?
Yeah, I think you know that to me, you know, for the currency markets, right, is absolutely key. And I think whilst, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, the potential intricacies, right, in the Chinese recovery story, you know, and what's going on there, you know, that's a real big, it's a lot of unknowns there, and it's a really complicated question. For me, CNH, CNY is very, very straightforward. It's about relative equities, it's about relative interest rates, and it really it's about risk premium, right? I think these are very, you know, for me, that's the, these three aspects are the key, sort of the main framework through which I think about CNY, CNH, right? But to kind of go back to your earlier question about what's been happening at around 7:30, definitely it's been pinned there for, you know, for quite a few months now, right? So I think there's sort of three main factors in my head that have been helping, you know, keep it there, right? So and I think these are all definitely functions of like an official response by the authorities to say, hey, you know, I think 7:30 should be capped, right? So, you know, we should cap the levels at 7:30 so it doesn't hit the year-to-date highs. You know, I'm sorry, right, it doesn't hit last year's highs at around, I think it was 7:49 or thereabouts, and doesn't sort of spike higher, right? So three, I think, official channels, right? The first one has been sort of the daily PBOC's fixings for CNY. So recall that CNY is sort of, it's a managed float. The PBOC every day fixes the midpoint of that float, of the currency's trading band, and CNY then trades in a plus minus sort of 2% range, up and down, right? So by fixing the midpoint, you're effectively capping how high dollar CNY can go on a daily basis, right? So that's the one thing. You know, over the last couple of weeks and months, you know, the PBOC's fixings have you know, basically screened the largest they've ever screened since the system started sort of in the mid 2010s, right? And the fixings on a daily basis are now exceeding, well in excess of 1,000 pips. Previously, our rule of thumb was something like, a 20 to 50 point deviation from the estimated fix would be a policy signal. So just to give you an idea, what we've been seeing are 1,000 point deviations from the estimates, right? So pretty big, right? So that's PBOC sort of telling you quite strongly, hey, we don't want stuff to really move outside of this trading range. The second point I think is fairly straightforward. It's been about sort of like I think sort of backdoor intervention, right? So throughout the periods of sort of more acute stress, like you mentioned throughout the summer, a lot of sort of news in the markets, chatter that you had that market participants were seeing, state banks sort of selling U.S. dollars and buying CNY. So I think that, fairly CNY and CNA, so both onshore and offshore. So I think fairly conventional methods of sort of intervening to prevent sort of the markets from getting too ahead of themselves and for the dollar to appreciate too much against the CNY. The third one, which I think has been quite interesting, is that over the last couple of months, not lots of central banks in this region have found sort of more creative ways to try to adjust supply and demand in their favor, right? To try to limit excessive demand of dollars. And what the PBOC has been doing has been effectively draining liquidity out of the offshore CNY, the offshore renminbi market, right? The CNH market. And it's been doing that through a couple of ways. So it's been doing that by issuing bonds in Hong Kong. And so as market participants buy the bonds, that naturally drains liquidity out of the system. And I think this year, if I remember correctly, is one of the largest years for issuance of bonds option like in Hong Kong by the PBOC, right? So that just goes, I mean, China doesn't need this sort of revenue, but it just goes to show that as a sort of market stabilization tool or sort of liquidity fine-tuning tool, that's been leaned into quite heavily. The other thing that's been happening quite that we've been noticing among some of our colleagues and on the screens as well is that's actually filtering through the forward curve, right? So what effectively what that means is that CNH is trading at an implied interest rates significantly higher than what actual interest rates are in China, which means that it just makes it a lot more expensive to be short CNH, right? So I think all three of these things have been sending consistently, very, very consistently strong signals that the authorities don't want to see the CNH and CNY depreciate too much. And I think given the fact that in Asia the FX trends have all been very one way, all very long dollars, it's definitely I feel take I definitely think it's taken a lot of interest out of some of these currency pairs and definitely taken a lot of interest out of being sort of short CNY and CNA. So I think overall, the PBOC has done a pretty good job in maintaining that sort of that sort of pegged or rather it's a sort of pinned exchange rate at around 7:30. Now, I think the real question really is how long can it continue to do so, and what's the trigger for the PBOC adjusting these parameters so CNY continues to weaken, right? If that's the case, are they holding out for dollar weakness like they did last year? Or, are they going to suddenly let these sort of depreciation pressures coalesce and we see dollar CNY move to new highs, 750, 760, whatever, sky's the limit. I think that's kind of the main question. And to me, it seems pretty opaque about how, what would cause them to swing either way.
Yeah, you made a lot of really good points there, but I want to sort of emphasize a couple of those. Really interesting on the difference between the interest rates implied by forward markets and the sort of policy rate and interest rates, elsewhere. Because, one of the things that we've talked about is the importance of relative rates and China's very low nominal policy rates as a reason why the Chinese currency had been under pressure. And so China using other options to try and increase those interest rates and make it more expensive to be short the currency is certainly very notable in that context of relative rates being so important in currencies. And I did want to ask you to sort of broaden out to other economies in your region, in EM Asia. You mentioned India already as one that's quite interesting, but more broadly, there's been a lot of central banks in region have they've been taking, have been employing strategies to try and offset or mitigate the impact of the globally stronger dollar in their economies. And the one that really jumps to mind as we record today on Thursday morning is what happened in Indonesia with the surprise rate hike that we got there by their central bank, which was, unashamedly taken to try and defend the currency from weakness. And so I'd love to talk to, I'd love to give you an opportunity to talk about what are some of the other themes in your region. You know, we do have China's near-term data have stabilized and have improved a little bit. That's probably good news for the backdrop, but I'd love to hear what are some of the other themes that, you know, you're talking about or that you're hearing from our accounts within the EM Asia space.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, it's a very interesting time, and it's also a very boring time. It's interesting because the data are all over the place. The trends are all over the place, right? Like, you know, you're seeing China sort of in a different cycle to the rest of the world. But at the same time, a lot of these export trends, the semiconductor trends, I think that that sort of period of deterioration, that period of peak, you know, deceleration in export growth in semiconductor manufacturing, that's over. So we're stabilizing at these new levels, right? You know, the sort of the chip war between the US and China, that only continues that's basically one way, right? And that's only going to escalate over time. You know, on the other hand, though, I think in terms of the currency space, that's also a little bit sort of lopsided, though. And that's kind of where it's the least interesting, because so much of Asia, you know, in our view, so much of the Asian currency trends are very much enmeshed, right? And very much sort of beholden to the dollar cycle, right? And that's what we saw last year. That's what we saw this year. You know, it's all very sort of beta driven. It's all very driven by what's happening in the dollars. Now, what central banks are doing is also kind of marginally interesting as well, because I think central banks are realizing that FX remains a key risk to their objectives, be it in inflation or in sort of currency stability or financial stability terms. So many of the central banks here, you know, despite the fact that they're considered, you know, emerging markets, they've actually bucked the trend of what's been happening in the broader emerging markets, right? That what we've been seeing, that, you know, in places like Eastern Europe and South America, central banks are cutting interest rates because they think that the inflation fight is over, or, you know, for whatever other objectives they might have, that, you know, interest rates are simply too high. But as you just mentioned, so, you know, Bank Indonesia today just raise interest rates to defend the currency. And so many other central banks here are either sort of threatening to raise interest rates and pushing back those rate cut expectations further out in 2024. There's a combination of that and also a combination of FX intervention. Right? So as you just mentioned, India is a very good example where they're doing both. They're managing expectations and they're actively sort of, a good way to describe it was almost pegging the currency to around, you know, the 83 level or thereabouts. The Central Bank of the Philippines, you know, Banco Central Filipinas, they're also doing the same, pushing back rate cut expectations, FX interventions. There may be some FX interventions in Korea as well, as well as pushing back, those expectations. So, you know, it's a combination of all this. And I think it's really, you know, they're being very prescient in trying to manage market expectations as well, so as not to let, you know, both the dollar cycle and sort of speculative capital move the currencies too much in a way that would be deemed unfavorable for, you know, their objectives, right? So definitely there's a very active and orthodox response, I think, from the central banks here, which is kind of, which for me, as, you know, looking from, I guess, like, if you think about it from a policy perspective, that's really good, because that shows they're very mature and they're very conscious about how capital markets work. But I think in contrast, it provides a lot less sort of uncertainty and a lot less volatility, which is why, I guess, in the EM space, so much of sort of capital flows and financial flows are rightly so focused on what's been going on in Latin America and Eastern Europe, right? So you can say that the fact that it is kind of boring in Asia is an interesting fact in itself.
Yeah, it is very interesting that we're talking about hawkish developments in EM Asia, while some other regions of emerging markets are either pausing or easing policy, because that's really a difference than what we've seen for really a lot of the last year and a half, 2 years, is you've seen very, very hawkish outcomes across Europe and Latin America, whereas the central banks in Asia were a little bit more on the cautious side in terms of nominal rate increases. Now you're seeing a little bit of the opposite way in some senses. But, you know, it seems like EM Asia is, you know, is beholden to the dollar cycle like a lot of other economies. And it certainly feels like we're all watching the U.S. data. We're all watching the Fed for really the biggest sign of what's the next move to come. And, you know, as long as the U.S. economy continues to chug along, I think these central banks are going to have to continue to kind of stay on the defensive as, you know, them and a lot of others are trying to fight the challenges that come with a stronger global dollar. So Galvin, I want to thank you for joining, and to our listeners, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider subscribing and liking the podcast. If you subscribe to the channel, that'll give you an opportunity to hear our latest podcasts when they're released. Thank you very much.